Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films F9, The Fast Saga, Werewolves Within, Fathom, An Unquiet Grave, and Central Park Season 2. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Time Machine. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first thing I want to talk about right now isn't even news. I want to answer a listener question, and this comes from our good friend Thomas from Seattle. He asked this several weeks ago to me on Twitter, and I just finally got around to getting it into the show. And he basically asks, were there any filmmakers that I thought came on really strong and were very impressive, but did not live up to their potential? Or did not pan out as I was expecting? And I'm going to give you three really quickly. The first one is Paul W.S. Anderson. Now, he started out with Mortal Kombat back when he did the original Mortal Kombat back in the 90s. But one of the movies that he directed after that was one of my favorite movies in sort of that subgenre category of horror movie on a spaceship, and that was Event Horizon. And I had a lot of excitement for his career, but he sort of ended up circling the drain with adaptations of video games. And he did that with Resident Evil. He did that. I think he did that Monster Hunter that came out last Christmas. So he's one that I thought had really great potential because I really, really loved Event Horizon. Another director who I think ended up fizzling his career is Kevin Smith. I mean, Clerks was a triumph of indie filmmaking from the 90s. And it's an interesting story of how it got noticed. And even though Mallrats, you know, Mallrats has its moments, but, you know, I didn't like Chasing Amy, but I thought his return for that stuff in the 90s, at least he was working within his wheelhouse, and he really had a chance to do something big, but boy, did he falter with stuff like Cop Out. And even before that, he kept trying to break into the big time, but he did not know how to negotiate that. And he now just sort of smokes weed and does podcasts and circles a wagon of his own work that is sort of depressing. He's like Cheech and Chong. If Cheech and Chong hadn't have matured and did other things, you know, he's this guy in his 50s still smoking weed and telling dirty jokes. It just doesn't work. And then the third one I want to hit is one that's going to get a lot of pushback on, and that is Christopher Nolan. I thought Christopher Nolan came on so strong with Memento. I know that wasn't his first movie. He did Following, which was okay. But Memento was a great film. And then, of course, he did Insomnia. That was really interesting with Robin Williams. And then he did the Batman movies. And boy, Dark Knight, he was at the top of his game. But The Dark Knight Rising wasn't nearly as good as The Dark Knight. And then he started doing movies like Interstellar, which were him sort of circling his inner, circling his artistic wagon. And stuff like, even like Dunkirk, which I know people loved. I thought it was half a movie. Well, for what they told, it was fine, but it was really an incomplete film. And then, of course, you had Tenet, which was interesting enough, but there was tons of problems with Tenet. So I really think Nolan is not the great filmmaker that he was coming on strong as. Now, one piece of news I want to hit. Let's go to the box office and talk about The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. And the reason I want to talk about that one is people didn't quite know how to report on this because they're like, The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard won. It was box office is, I guess, kind of back. It won with just over $11 million. And it had a total gross at the end of the weekend of close to $17 million, which on its own wouldn't be bad, but it had been open since Wednesday. And I think they rolled in the sneak previews from the previous weekend into all that. So that's literally 3 days extra it got added to it. So it had something like the equivalent of, you know, a 6-day opening week, and it still only made less than $17 million. It did not do well. And I think part of it is because it was kind of a crappy movie. Now, does that mean box office isn't back, baby? Well, I mean, still doing well for A Quiet Place. The Quiet Place is over $125 million. Godzilla vs. Kong, midweek, finally crossed the century mark and made $100 million in the domestic box office. And that's with the tie-in to watching it on HBO Max when it was out that first month. So now it's on DVD. When it's on DVD and Blu-ray, it finally cracks that 100 million marker. It's not about movies being back. It's that good movies are back. We get this every year. People, you need to manage your expectations when you report the box office. So, yes, the box office is still getting the dust out of its gears, and more people get vaccinated, and more we get closer to normal, the better it's going to be. But again, I'm telling you, the bellwether is going to be in 2 weeks. See what happens with Black Widow. That is the one to watch. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Snake Eyes, part of G.I. Joe Origins, or as I like to call it, G.I. Georgians. Snake Eyes comes into theaters on July 23rd.
You saved my life. We are going home. I can't change your past. But I can offer you a purpose. For 600 years, our ninja have brought peace to the world.
All right, what do I have to do?
If you survive, you will gain access to our knowledge and our power.
Cobra is coming.
What's Cobra?
A shadow organization devoted to global revolution.
I'm sorry to say, but this kind of looks generic to me. There's a certain feel of action movies now because there's so much CGI and virtual sets used that it almost looks like it's animated. You got that a little bit with Mortal Kombat, but I think actually Mortal Kombat seemed to avoid that. But boy, the Snake Eyes trailer, nothing's popping in this movie to me. And I don't know if it's going to do any good. I don't know how good it's going to be. Do you remember that movie a couple years ago called, actually it was more like 10 or 12 years ago, called Ninja Assassin, I think was the name of the movie. And it was the Wachowskis were somehow involved in it. And that movie was okay. And it was a fine little action movie, but there was so much digital work and CGI that it felt almost like it was an animated film. And I think that's going to be a problem for a lot of movies as we move forward. To go back to the good old-fashioned practical effects, that's what makes the 80s such a pinnacle of action, because you couldn't do the CGI work, and because the CGI was in its infancy, you had to rely on practical effects. And if you don't, it might be easier in the long run, but it does ring false. The next one I want to hit is The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which opens in theaters on September 17th.
Tammy and I are undergoing the most vicious attacks.
Serving God don't feel like it should be a money-making opportunity.
You know, when I saw that clipping with my face on it, I thought for a second that you were proud of me.
Oh, Tammy Faye, you follow blindly. In the end, all you are is blind. These
eyes. I just want to love people. Cry
every night. The devil's coming for me, Tammy.
Can we talk about Satan later, Jim?
You know, it's clearly an award bait film, and you've got Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield, both of whom have been nominated for Oscars. But even just from the trailer, I think they're going a little soft on Tammy Faye. Now, look, I mean, I understand there's some good elements to her. I think it was great her breaking from the pack in the televangelist world to put a spotlight on AIDS and gay rights. I think that's wonderful, and I know in a lot of ways she's a gay icon now, and it's not just because of the makeup. But she was not infallible, and I do not believe that she was that isolated from the shenanigans going on with her husband, Jim Baker. And I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for people who fleece the public for obvious political or religious gains. So I think she's just as sleazy as her sleazy husband was. It's just she was protected from not manufacturing the books himself. But she knew what was going on. But also, at the same time, she was instrumental in bringing a certain amount of attention to AIDS in the 80s, and nobody was talking about, certainly not in that world. So, I don't know. I mean, this movie looks like it's just going to be too much of a softball for her, but who knows? We'll see. I'm sure it's going to be touted during award season. We'll see if it can last past September. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Werewolves Within and An Unquiet Grave.
Thank you.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with the horror films for the week, and that starts off with Werewolves Within. A small resort town in Vermont is snowed in while there appears to be a werewolf stalking the residents.
Preacher, you look like you just seen a corpse.
Well, the roads are effed, and something's wrong with the generator.
Which generator?
All of them.
Make it on the internet!
Also, there's a dead body under your porch.
Holy!
Probably a wolf.
What are you, like a wolf detective, Mel Marcus?
Who knows who or when it's gonna kill next?
This is an independent film, and it's being released by IFC Midnight, which oftentimes means something pretty heavy and grim, but it's not. It's actually a comedy. Now, it's based on a video game called Werewolves Within by, I think, Ubisoft. And as I understand, I've never played the game, but I did a little, just a quick reading on it. And the game itself is people in a village, and one of them's a werewolf. You have to figure out who the werewolf is. Sort of like Clue with werewolves in the medieval times, because it takes place in the past. The movie itself takes place in a contemporary setting, but it still has the same thing as you don't know who the werewolf is. It's sort of like The Beast Must Die, if you remember that old movie with that it was an Amicus film with Peter Cushing. And that one was you had to figure out who was a werewolf. They actually, in that movie, had a werewolf break where they put a ticking clock and you had to figure out who the werewolf was. They don't have that in Werewolves Within. But it is that setup of a bunch of people in the room trying to figure out who the werewolf is. Now, it stars Sam Richardson as the new sheriff in town. He's coming in to help things out and getting to know the town itself. And there's a bunch of weirdo people in the town. There's like, you know, people that are this marginally crazy couple. There's a gay couple who runs sort of like a boutique. There's this older couple who are a little bit, kind of goofy in their own way. And there's a guy who's trying to build a pipeline through the town. And of course, that's causing a lot of consternation because some people don't want it and some people want it. Some people want to sell out. Some people want to keep it pure. So it's dealing with all the internal politics of a small town. Also in the mix is Milana von Trubb, who is best known for being in the AT&T commercial. She's Lily, the AT&T girl. And she's adorable. I find her really cute in the AT&T commercials. I think she's really just sort of this bubbly, sweet little personality. And she plays a character here. And I'm starting to see her actually show up in other things. She was in that movie Die Hard on, it was on Quibi, but now it's on Roku channel. And she plays the lone postal carrier there. And so she's sort of showing Sam Richardson the ropes in the town, showing who's who and introducing him to everybody. But, it's not a horror. I mean, it is a horror movie, but it's not a violent horror movie. There's a couple gory scenes, marginally gory scenes. But overall, it's a comedy. It's a lot of deadpan delivery. It's some slapstick here and there. There's some just overt jokes, but a lot of it's just people into awkward situations. And, both Weintraub and Richardson do a great job with that. They play off the situations quite well. And they're both very pleasant to watch on screen. And I'd love to see, Weintraub do more. I think she's adorable. She fits in that adorkable mode that, it's not that manic pixie dream girl. It's kind of like the cute, slightly off-centered, girl. And, I mean, she's great. I'd love to see her do more. And of course, Sam Richardson, you've seen him in other things and he's funny. They have a great cast in here and they all kind of work well together and they, cover their bases, as they're trying to figure out who's the werewolf and who's not. And like I said, it's not like a werewolf killing wall to wall. A lot of it's about them trying to figure it out. It's about the suspicion, which is kind of where the essence of the game comes from. And I enjoyed it. I will say I was not 100% satisfied with the ending, but that's okay. It's always kind of hard to stick the landing on something with a setup as good as this, but it's worth checking out. It did everything it needed to do for a movie for me. So I'm going to have to say that Werewolves Within kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about An Unquiet Grave, which is playing exclusively on Shudder this week. A grieving widower works with his dead wife's twin sister to bring her back from the dead.
Is it weird for you, seeing me, because I look like her?
I don't want to talk about that.
Jamie, can you really do it?
Yeah, but I can't do it without you.
What if we're doing the wrong thing?
There isn't any right or wrong. There's just what happens. Jules was killed. And tonight we're gonna bring her back.
Something was here, and it wasn't Jules.
This was a very independent film. It got picked up by Shudder, so it's a Shudder exclusive now. It won a couple awards at a couple smaller film festivals, some fringe film festivals. It's a disturbing character study of grief, is really what it is. This guy's had been in a car accident with his wife, and she had died, and his wife's twin sister sets out to help him bring her back from the dead. And you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you know something bad is going to, you know, you don't set that up and everyone lives happily ever after. There's always something bad that happens. There's always consequence from trying to raise people from the dead. And it basically stars two people, and that's it. And, you know, of course, her being a twin, you know, the actress can be either one. And so it's not, I mean, it's not overtly scary. It's one of those, it's more just disturbing. It's uncomfortable. And it's one of those things that makes you wonder what you would do in that situation. How far would you go and who would you hurt in order to bring back one of your loved ones? And then if you did, would your loved one be okay with that? If you were married and your spouse got killed and the only way to bring that spouse back was to kill an innocent child, would you do that? You know, would you make that sacrifice? I'd like to think I wouldn't. I mean, and I wouldn't, not just because it'd be an abhorrent thing to do, but because if I were to be able to bring my wife back from being dead, but in order to do so, having to kill a child, she would not appreciate that. She would say, no way, not at all, not at all. I don't want to be involved in that. And it does deal with those levels of consent. And I would not call it a grand movie. It is very intimate. It's very small. In some ways, it reminds me of this other movie I talked about on Shudder called Violation, where this girl's trying to exact revenge on, I think it's her best friend's husband or something like that. It's just disturbing because you're set up with this situation and it's right there and there's no way around it and you're confronted with it through the whole film. And you also know, like I said, you know bad things are going to happen. You know that things are not going to go as hunky-dory. But it's an interesting movie because I think one of these things that you can do with independent horror film and low budget horror is you can put people in an isolated situation and really explore what a character can do. And that's what this is about. And this is about grief and it's about recovery and it's about longing. And like I said, it's also about consent and it's about evil doing and it's about the lengths you would go and whether you should go and whether you have a regret about doing that itself. You know, in terms of the filmmaking style, you know, it's pretty straightforward, Cabin in the Woods sort of feel to it. But it's not jumping out at me in any way of its construction. It's more about knowing bad things are going to happen and then seeing them play out and then seeing how people deal with it. So it's worth checking out. If you've got Shudder, if you spent the money for that service, it's out there right now. You can check it out on the service. And that is An Unquiet Grave, which I say kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about F9, The Fast Saga, and Central Park Season 2. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the big movie that is here for the week, and that is F9, The Fast Saga. Dominic Toretto and his crew are tapped for another international spy mission to stop a rogue agent from getting his hands on a piece of tech that can take over all the computers on the planet.
No matter how fast you are, no one outruns their past. And mine just caught up to me.
Been a long time, Dom.
So we're up against a master thief, assassin, high performance driver. Who is he?
Jacob is Dom's brother.
I'm not going to spoil anything, but I do have one question to ask, and I want everyone to contemplate this when you go see this movie. Where does Charlize Theron go to the bathroom? Just think about that. There's a real Brady Bunch house situation going on in her scenes. That's where my mind went in a movie like this. Anyways, I don't know what else you can really say about a movie like this aside from it's a Fast and Furious movie. You got to remember, in the first movie, they were stealing VCRs and doing illegal street racing. And now they're doing things like fighting tanks and submarines and going into freaking space in a car. This is a level of absurdity that these films don't even digest themselves. Pay attention to Tyrese Gibson's character in this. It does him very well to be in these. I would love to be in a Fast and Furious movie. I wouldn't have to work again in my life until they made another Fast and Furious movie. You know, I could be driving the big car because I'm so fat. But anyways, Tyrese Gibson's character almost becomes self-aware in this film, almost realizes what's going on, and is almost at the point where he understands that he's in an absurd film series. And that's some of the best parts of this movie, because he's trying to work it out, but his character's not very bright. But they have other things. I mean, you see in the trailer, there are people back who, you know, we thought were dead a long time ago. And these movies are turning into caricatures of themselves. I mean, do you remember in the seventh movie when a car leaps through the window of a building and into another building through the window? Like a skyscraper. This one is even more ridiculous. No one wears a seatbelt except for one character in one scene, and it's part of the joke. This is absurd. These cars are rolling over and exploding, but that's kind of the fun of it. These cars are high-performance cars driving through the jungle, getting landmines exploded underneath them, and they're just sailing along. Where these cars in real life, if you just hit a speed bump too fast, you're going to ruin your undercarriage. But the whole point is these movies have gone so ridiculously over the top, there's nowhere else for them to go except for space, which they do in this movie. In a car. I mean, well, at this point, why not just build a rocket? No, because it's got to be a car. I mean, the movies themselves don't take themselves seriously, and you shouldn't either. They're entertainment. Now, granted, this movie's 2.5 hours long. Probably doesn't need to be. A lot of the Fast and Furious movies are fast and furious and long. But they're entertaining. I mean, look, there's the old saying, give the people what they want, and this is exactly what they're doing with this film. Now, Justin Lin directs this, and he directed like the last one, and I think he did 5 and 6 as well. He didn't do 7. James Wan did that one. But Justin Lin's kind of going through his greatest hits. This is not as good or as exciting as the last couple ones. I think 5 through 8 pretty much hit a stride. This is a lesser of a movie than those, but it's still a heck of a lot of fun to watch and absurd and ridiculous. I couldn't tell you what the plot really is because, I mean, they literally describe that. Oh, there's this device that controls all the computers ever made. And you're like, well, that's kind of overshooting it, but who cares? It's not James Bond, it's Austin Powers. And in that sense, it's fun to watch. As long as you don't find yourself shackled to the earth with physics or logic or character development or anything remotely masquerading as intelligent character design, it's fun. They do these flashbacks to the 80s, which is, it hurts me because it flashes back to like 1989 and it's all sepia toned. I mean, it looks like it was shot in the, you know, on old film from the 60s. And I'm like, that's not the way the 80s look. But anyways, and so it's kind of evoking a feel of the old stock car racing movies from the 70s, you know, like Checkered Flag or Crash or, you know, Fast Company or something like that. But it's fun. This is a Fast and Furious movie. It's not as good as the last couple ones, but it's still enjoyable to watch. So, you know, people have waited long enough for it. Good for you. You now have your movie. And I have to say, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Central Park Season 2. This award-winning musical animated sitcom from Apple TV Plus follows a family who lives in and takes care of Central Park as they try to stop an ancient socialite from developing the land.
You made dinner.
Wait, what is that?
Hot dogs and macaroni.
Perfect, no notes.
We'll need new music and choreography.
Shake it, Helen!
When they find out what I've got cooking, they're gonna line up at Bitsy's soup kitchen for a handout, and I'll say, get away from my soup, it's made for me. Now I want soup.
With these plans, I'll be able to buy Central Park.
Central Park. It's the private place we share. It's from all that we live. Central Park.
This has won like an NAACP Image Award because of all the characters. They have mixed race and they have black people and different races, and they have a diverse cast. Well, one of the big things that happened with racial issues last year is Kristen Bell, who used to play the part of the daughter, and the parents are a black guy and a white woman. Kristen Bell bowed out of the show and she said, I shouldn't be playing a girl of mixed race. Because if you know who Kristen Bell is, she was on The Good Place. She was on Veronica Mars. She's a marshmallow. She's as white as a marshmallow. And a lot of people applauded her for that, and they got a new woman to come in to play her. Of course, they got the person who's having sex with Daveed Diggs, which then questions whether or not they were hired because they were good or just because she's sleeping with one of the stars. I don't know. Not to cast aspersions, but, you know, it's Hollywood, and Hollywood still likes to play nepotism a lot. But here's my issue with that. And I don't care who's playing what part. And it doesn't bother me that Stanley Tucci and Daveed Diggs are playing white women. And Daveed Diggs is a black guy playing a white woman. Or that Phil LaMarr is playing a white guy in it. That doesn't bother me. I don't care. But if Kristen Bell is not supposed to play this part because it's a girl of mixed race, her brother's character is played by Titus Burgess, who's very, very dark skin, and I mean, everyone has a certain level of mixed race in him, but he's not like half and half mixed race. He is as racially accurate to his role as Kristen Bell was. But why did Kristen Bell have to graciously leave? I think this is where they take it a little bit too far. This show is not the problem in terms of diverse casting. Anyways, when it comes to the show itself, it's a cute little show. I enjoyed the first season. I like the style. It's done by the people who do Bob's Burgers, so you got the same style of animation, and it's got that very deadpan humor. It's not as edgy as Bob's Burgers is. It's a little bit more, I wouldn't say it's 100% family oriented, because there are some blue jokes in there and there are some dirty jokes in there, but it's a charming little show. Now, one of the things it is a musical, and so they do have song and dance numbers through it. And it's impressive to see them do the choreography and all the Busby Berkeley moments. Although they do lean a bit too much into the music on this one. And I know there's some people out there who just love musicals. But as In the Heights proved a couple weeks ago, that's not a ubiquitous thought among everybody. It's just the problem is that some of the shows lean too much into the music. Some of the shows, it just goes on too long. Because a lot of times the songs don't really develop the plot. They're just there to push home a point. And that's always been my complaint about musicals is the songs, too many times, their songs are, okay, we're just going to pause for the next 3 minutes and have a song and dance number that's not furthering the plot or the characters at all. But it's going to look cool and sound neat. So they do that in this one. I got a little bit tired of the production numbers, especially the ones where it really seems to be more singing than dialogue. That's a small price to pay. It's still a charming little show with a great cast, and it's a lot of fun. It's one of the reasons to get Apple TV Plus. There's some good stuff on there, and this is one of them. So I'm going to have to say Central Park Season 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Fathom and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Time Machine. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with our movie reviews and finish things up with Fathom. Two scientists study the language of humpback whales to gain a better understanding of how the species communicates.
The oldest cultures are not human. They're from the ocean. Whales evolved to build relationships in the dark.
I'm trying to start a conversation is the most basic way you can say it. I'm going to put a speaker in the ocean and talk to a whale and hope it talks back.
Now, like Central Park, this is on Apple TV Plus. There was just the Disney series Secret of the Whales that came out on Disney Plus. Now, if you're just sort of like a casual nature film viewer, those are a little more appropriate because those dive right in with the whales and you see a lot of spectacle. This is a little bit more of a hard science movie. It's about the whales, sure, but it's really more about the process by which these women are studying the whales. One of them's up in Alaska. I think the other one's is somewhere in the islands of the Pacific. And they're studying humpback whale sounds. And each one has a different goal. One of them, the woman who's in the islands, she is trying to see if there's a difference in regions and sort of track the movement of the sounds and whether whales from different parts of the ocean sing differently in that. And that's interesting because she's out there and she's putting microphones in the water. But the other scientist is up in Alaska. And what she's trying to do is she's actually trying to communicate with them, like actually have a call and response, which is very, very difficult to do, especially when you have two different creatures that are so evolutionarily diverse and not companions. And it's not like a dog, where a dog is a very different species, but they've grown to live with humans for so long that you can communicate with a dog. We don't communicate with whales. And it's her trying to figure out, how do they say hello? And what's interesting about it, and this is a great thing to watch if you want to understand how science works, it's slow and it's meticulous, and you see just the insane nuance that these people are putting into just the littlest things, and it's lost on everybody except these people who are doing it. And that's fascinating, but that shows why there's been such trouble, for example, with people understanding how the science works behind the coronavirus, because you're watching science work in real time. And science is messy and it's sloppy and you have to guess and check and test. And it takes forever to get any real answers, any concrete answers, which is why it was so confusing with something like the coronavirus over the last year and a half. This thing shows how they're really shooting in the dark here, trying to figure stuff out. And when they get a breakthrough, how monumental it is. But it's a great way, if you want to see how real science works, it's good to see that, because it's really more interesting, less about the whales and more about the women that are doing this and sort of what this kind of work does to them and what kind of a person it takes. And, you know, because you really have to remove yourself from society to do this. And, you know, one of them's married and she's dealing with some issues, you know, being away from her husband. And the other one is having trouble almost at times reassimilating into society. So it's a fascinating look, less fascinating about the whales, but more about the people who are studying them and what this level of study does and what kind of a person it takes. So I found it interesting, again, less for the whales and more about the psychology aspect of it. So I'm going to have to say Fathom kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week I had some free time to watch some movies just on my own and not have to do them for the show. And then I decided, well, I've watched them, let's talk about them on the show. And one of them I swerved into, it was on Hulu, because I've kind of neglected Hulu for a while in terms of just watching it casually. And so I was seeing what was on there and I ran across The Time Machine from 2002, which is a remake. Guy Pearce stars as a scientist from the early 1900s who invents a time machine that hurls him 800,000 years into the future.
Time travel.
It's possible, sir.
Not in this world.
Where do you come from?
I'm from the past.
I wonder if we'll ever go too far.
With what?
With this, with all of this.
No such thing.
Why have you traveled through time?
To have a question answered. Why can't one change the past?
Why would you want to? You lost someone. Someone you loved very much. You should go back to your own time.
This is loosely based on the original 1960s movie and loosely based on H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. Interesting enough, it's directed by Wells' grandson, Simon Wells, which you'd think, oh, it's part of the family. He should do it justice. Mm-mm. I read The Time Machine a long time ago, like maybe 25 years ago. It's not a long book. It's a breeze to get through. And what's interesting is there's a lot of politics in the book because H.G. Wells was a socialist, and his description of the Eloi and the Morlocks in the book were straight out of the bourgeoisie and the proletariats and their population dynamics. Now, of course, that's how he saw these two castes of society evolving over hundreds of thousands of years. But it's not even hidden in the book. He talks about it using terms like proletariat and bourgeoisie. They mask that a lot more in the movies. But this one, they steer away from the bourgeoisie Eloi, which are meant to be these perfect flower people in the future that live a life of leisure. Well, these are more natives in this one. They steer away from the cultivated characters of the Eloi from the original book. And it's more, you know, sort of this Native American tribe that has a certain degree of architecture because they build these interesting dwellings. And then the Morlocks, they give a little bit more depth to as well, because like Jeremy Irons plays the King Morlock, and apparently there's a little bit more planning going on, and they're not just troglodyte monsters. And it's interesting because it does deal with causality, and it does deal with the question of why you can't change the past. That was never dealt with in Wells' original book because it really hadn't gotten sophisticated enough in science fiction yet for that. But it makes for an interesting movie. There's parts of it I really, really like, but it just never quite clicks, and it never quite fires on all cylinders. And you can tell that Simon Wells as a director is a little bit inexperienced. So while I appreciate the ambition of 2002's The Time Machine, all it really did was make me want to watch the one from 1960. So I'm going to have to say this one kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Since watching 2002's The Time Machine only made me want to go back and watch the 1960 version of it with Rod Taylor and directed by George Powell, I did. At the turn of the 19th century, an inventor develops a time machine and explores far into the world's future.
Why is it that we usually ignore the fourth dimension? You see, we can move in the other three. As the doctor said, up, down, forwards, backwards, sideways. But when it comes to time, we are prisoners.
Inventor Rod Taylor's breakthrough into the realm of the fourth dimension is defied by his friend Alan Young.
If that machine can do what you say it can, destroy it, George, before it destroys you.
Every moment is a year, hurtling through the atomic wars of the future on an incredible excursion into the unknown.
Now, again, comparing this to the book, it's a lot closer to the book. This one follows the book much, much better, and that's part of it. That's George Powell. You know, he didn't take as much liberties as some directors especially do today. And it does have that epic feel to it. And it's still a neat movie. I remember watching it when I was a kid. My dad took me to like the public library where they showed it, you know, because I would have seen it when I was like, you know, what, the late 70s. So it was less than 20 years after it came out. But it's a wonderful film with some really, you know, innovative special effects, because they do a bunch of time-lapse photography as he's moving ahead in time. And that is still impressive to watch. And it goes a lot closer to what the Morlocks and the Eloi were in the book, to my recollection. There's still the absurdity of them speaking English. Because even if they did preserve a language over 800,000 years, over almost a million years, that language would have changed a little bit, at least. And over almost a million years, I mean, even like the stone masonry of these buildings would probably have worn away just by erosion. Because that's a million years. That's way longer than the sum total of humans having been on this earth. But I still unabashedly adore George Powell's version of The Time Machine. I think it really has the epic feel that you need in a movie. And it hasn't quite gotten to the goofiness of the 60s yet, because it's just right in that turn of the decade. I really do enjoy this one because I think it's authentic. It feels very much like the book. I think it strives to be like the book, and it achieves it in a really stellar way. And, you know, some goofiness aside, it's still a really neat movie and holds up today. Like I said, I watch it. I like it better than the 2002 version. So I'm going to have to say that this version of The Time Machine totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Forever Purge, Zola, The Boss Baby, Family Business, and The Tomorrow War. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.